generous support for Coastal Windage comes from Cameron's Restaurant Pub and Inn, and now RV Park. Cameron's is the only true British pub on the coastside, featuring 19 beers on tap and more than 60 brands of bottles. Come for the food and stay for the fun. Happy hour specials Monday through Friday. Open mic night on Thursday and karaoke on Friday and Saturday. Cameron's Restaurant Pub in Half Moon Bay.
Broadcasting live from the KHMB studios in downtown Half Moon Bay. This is Coastal Windage, the talk of the coast. The coastside's own live call-in talk radio show. From Pescadero to Pacifica and beyond, this is the place for coastside issues, hot topics, and you. And now, the host of Coastal Windage, Mr. Ruben Truthmaker, and his co-host, Crystal Lynn.
All right, Coastsiders, good morning. It's Friday. For some reason, I almost said February. Not yet.
All close.
Yeah, it's Friday, January 23rd, 2026. Time for some Coastal Windage. I'm Ruben, and this is Crystalyn. Good morning, Crystalyn. And today with us on our show, we have a very special guest in our Shooting the Breeze live interview, Coastside cyclist, and he's kind of bummed my high a little bit, but now former world record holder, but at one time world record holder, Philip Plath. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning.
I'm going to call you Phil, though. I like Phil, if that's okay.
That's fine.
So, Phil, in addition to numerous cycling accolades, including the world record at one time and other records that we'll talk about later in the show. Like myself, Phil, you are a bicycle accident survivor. And when I say survivor, not just some road rash, like serious injuries from a similar incident involving a dog. And so we'll get into that too. Yeah, I'm coming up on the one-year anniversary of my accident, February 9th, so this is really special for Phil to make time to come in here. I kind of originally thought of this as like, oh, I'm going to help Phil because he's going to be going through the same thing. And right now I was telling him, like, I'm kind of struggling a little bit on the one-year anniversary, so he's here to help me now, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Phil. So we'll be talking with Phil about cycling, about personal training, about recovering from this injury and the accident. Other topics today, Half Moon Bay High School baseball fever. Catch it. Crystalyn, are you a baseball person?
I like to play softball. I'm usually on the Half Moon Bay League.
I know that. We've been teammates for many years on that. But I mean, like, would you watch a baseball game on TV?
Not on TV, but I'll go to a game.
Yes, baseball games to go to. How about you, Phil? Baseball fan?
Yes, a baseball fan. And when I want to spend $20 on a beer, I absolutely want to go to the stadium.
Yeah, I mean, that. Okay, yes. I've long said, like, baseball games in person are the awesome, like, date night.
Yeah.
Because the baseball is going on in the background. And unlike an NBA game where you can't hear yourself think because they're just pounding, like, music nonstop, even through the playing. At a baseball game, there's periods of quiet and nothing happening and in between pitches. And then, oh, every once in a while. So, and it's 2 or 3 hours. And so you have a chance to get to know the person. And in those moments when maybe there's nothing to say, you can turn and watch the baseball game, and then it gets boring after a while, and so then you go back to talking, and after the game is over, like, you feel like you maybe know the person. So it's, you know, baseball games are fun to go to because they play out. You know, you got to, like, be there for the game, and you can't drop in. I mean, you could drop in for an inning, but anyway. So baseball fever at the high school, we'll catch that. Coastside Circuits, the middle school team of the Half Moon Bay Robotics Club, has a competition tomorrow on their home turf. We'll talk about that. They're going to be taking on other robotics teams from all around the Bay Area. And, of course, in the back half of our show, the Shooting the Breeze live interview with Phil Plath. Okay. Phil, feel free to weigh it. Phil, feel free. Wow. I should have practiced that one. Feel free to jump in on any of these topics. You got anything to say, anything to add, please do. Okay, here's our air quality report. Nobody else does this. No other radio program in the history of radio has ever done this or is doing it now except us. The scale for air quality, 0 to 50, is incredible. 51 to 100 is pretty good. Past that, we don't bother with here on the coast side. We're never there. But today, we're not having the greatest air quality that we have. Usually, we're in the single digits or teens. 34 today in El Granada, which is still squarely incredible. But for us, it's like, meh. 34 in El Granada, 37 in Half Moon Bay, 79 over in Redwood City. They got the smokestacks going over there in Redwood City. And today, again, in Santa Cruz, 55, not great in Santa Cruz. And listeners, as you know, every week we give an Easter egg location, which if you can figure out why we provided that location, you call in and we'll give you some, and correctly tell us why, we'll give you some windage bucks, which is over $100 in discounts in local restaurants and merchants. Okay, today's Easter egg location, Battle Mountain, Nevada. 15 today in Battle Mountain, Nevada.
Ooh.
Okay. Battle Mountain. Is there a lot of battles in Nevada? I don't think so, but okay. There's been some epic battles, maybe not with guns, but okay, we'll get to that. All right. Did you guys see this? Okay, clickbait, sure, maybe. Real or AI? These days you got to ask. But did you guys see that video of the coyote swimming to Alcatraz? Speaking of amazing physical feats.
Incredible.
Right? I mean, in the bay, through the maritime traffic, one, then the currents of the bay. You know, this coyote probably weighs 35 pounds, 40 pounds maybe. And then where's it coming from? Probably Angel Island, right? Which it had to swim to or been born there. Anyway, swimming to Alcatraz and then hauling itself up on the rocks, looking pretty bedraggled. Yet here's the thing about coyotes that I love. They are indestructible. There's a reason that Wile E. Coyote was that character. It was based on a real coyote, but you can't kill them. And they are critical for the ecosystem as a scavenger, you know.
Did they rescue it?
No. It was doing its thing. It was doing its coyote thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Just, you know, probably as coyotes, you know, you see them everywhere. I see them on Sonora here in El Granada all the time, just cruising down the street, you know, on their way from point A to point B.
Yeah, that I get. But swimming in the ocean to an island seems... Well, do they normally do that?
I mean, maybe he was training for the Alcatraz Triathlon.
Oh, there we go.
Although, Phil, I think he's going to struggle on the bike part of it.
I think
the swimming and the running, he might do well, but the bike part, I bet you could catch him on that.
Yeah, I think barely.
Okay. Speaking of the coyote swimming to Alcatraz, you know, Phil is, as he let me know before the show, he's now a former world record holder, but I still, in my mind, he achieved a world record and he held it for many years. But, Phil, you're only the second world record holder we've had on the show. Back in September of 2024, we had Amy Applehands Gubser on the show, who swam from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Farallones. The only person ever in the history of ever to do that.
I will say, and I'm going to probably butcher this, so apologies if I have this wrong. I do believe my dad held a world record for 24 hours or something.
What was that for?
I think it was doubles tennis, the longest played doubles tennis game in high school. But then like a rival school, I think, broke it like a couple days later. But
3 world record holders on this show?
Apologies if I have that wrong,
wow.
Dad.
Wow, okay. All right. Well, Phil, you've joined celebrated company here.
Wow. And right? By the way, who's keeping track of the length of these doubles matches in high school? That's incredible.
Yeah, I think they were over 24 hours.
What?
Yeah.
What did it go to, like 340 to 339? Like, had, you know, deuce. Just give it to me.
We can ask Dad Brad on his next.
Yeah, oh my gosh. 24 hours. I mean, I don't like tennis that much. So I think at some point you'd just be like, you know what, dude, I'll give you $20. Just missed a shot. Let's go home. You know.
At that point, even the tennis players don't like tennis that much.
Yeah, really.
Well, he still plays to this day.
Okay, that would be the kind of thing. If I would be like, okay, it's over. Set the record. Here's my tennis racket. I never want to see it again. All right, that's pretty incredible, Dad Brad. Nice. Super Bowl traffic on the coast side. So there's been some articles that Super Bowl, there's going to be more traffic at the airport here in Half Moon Bay. And that's not maybe, but not exactly. So the Niners aren't in the Super Bowl, and the Super Bowl is happening in 2 weeks on February 8th over in Santa Clara. So there is going to be, you know, more people here in the coast side. And so coming for the Super Bowl, because of that, traffic measures are in effect here on the coast side. Rumor has it that folks on the coast side are going to be charging $100 an hour so that Super Bowl goers can park in the driveways and then take the gondola over to the stadium. So that's there's going to be all this traffic over here with people parking and taking the gondola, you know, because the gondola is going to solve all of our traffic problems. Of course, they would need a helicopter to get over here on a sunny Sunday to park and then take the gondola back. So that's not really going to work, gondola people. It's not going to work. Okay, but the traffic measures are for the airport. The FAA, yes, uh-huh. The FAA has, because they're expecting, I guess, a bunch of rich people to fly in on their private planes, is putting the special event reservation program in place for arrivals and departures around the area, Bay Area, for the week of the game. I guess Bay Area airports have to sign up for this program, which, as the name indicates, I guess you have to specifically reserve your arrival and departure time at these airports. Small airports like Half Moon Bay, Palo Alto, and San Carlos, but also the big ones, SFO, Oakland, SJO. So we might see a few of those luxury G6s polluting our skies Super Bowl weekend. And again, so they fly into here, their G6 into the Half Moon Bay Airport, but then they are going to need a helicopter to get to Levi Stadium because on a sunny Sunday, as we had last weekend, I don't know if anybody tried to go anywhere on Monday. Traffic was backed up, you know, getting out of here at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So good luck, all you rich people flying in for the Super Bowl.
I will say, people are going to be mad. I was stuck in that traffic, and it only
on Monday.
On Monday, yeah. We had an event to go to over the hill.
Oh.
And we left at 4:26, and we timed it. And between our apartment in Miramar to the crest of 92 only added 15 minutes.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
What? It only took you 15 minutes to get
there? No. It didn't take 15 minutes, but it only added 15 minutes to the normal traffic time. So I'm just putting that out there that sometimes the traffic is more a perceived.
What time of day was that?
We left at 4:26.
What? Because I had a basketball practice on Monday at Cunha. I left Cunha at 5 o'clock, and it took me over 45 minutes to get from Cunha to El Granada. Over 45 minutes. Most of that time, because traffic at that time, it came out of the Cunha gym, traffic was backed up all the way down Kelly from Highway 1 back to Main Street. Highway 1 was backed up, like, past the Kelly light, as far as you could see, just gridlock. It took most of that time to get from Cunha to the Highway 1 92 interchange. After that, because everybody was going 92 to go home, it got better, but you still have to get that weave there, like at mm-hmm. the McDonald's, it always is a problem. So it took 45 minutes to get home from Cunha on Monday. That's 6 miles, so not enjoying that. Okay, but the way you drive, maybe it's that Bronco. You were up on the shoulder, just, you know.
Just rolling over.
It's like the flying cars. There's no boundaries for your Bronco.
Big wheels will travel.
Totally. You should have that, like, tattooed on your leg. Okay, Cunha, speaking of basketball, Cunha sixth grade basketball tryouts. They're not called tryouts anymore. That's just too harsh. They're called assessments now. So the basketball assessment. How is that any better? I mean, seriously, kids, you're not going to try out and see which team. We're going to assess you and then put you in a category of skill level.
Yeah, do they have like a category of not this year, but we'll give you help to be better for next year? Because they do that in swim. Best fiancé Jesse, his group does that for their swim club.
No, one of the things I love about Cunha After School Sports is there's no cuts. So
yeah, that's the same with the swim team.
We have A teams and B teams, but as many kids that want to play, they'll make extra teams. But there's usually an A team and then, whoops, sorry, Phil. Kicked Phil there. That's exactly what I don't need to do. Easy there. So there's no cuts. We'll make as many B teams as possible. And the B teams are kind of the developmental teams.
Yeah.
Right? Which is another thing I love about Cunha. It's a chance for kids to play a sport that maybe they'll never play again or have never played before. And here's a great opportunity to learn that sport, to play in a league, to get coaching. Have the school pride. The favorite day of the season for every kid, for some reason, is uniforms. When are we getting uniforms? When do we get the uniforms? They love putting on that Cunha uniform, and it's really fun to see. So
they do that. They do that in the swim league also that Jesse is a part of, where it's like there's the kids and they are competition level and all of that. And then especially the younger kids might not be far enough along, so they make the team, air quotes, but then essentially their season is like more in-depth extended like swim lessons, and then with the hope that next year, but same, they get the uniform and they get to go to all the meets and all that, so it's really cute.
The Cunha is a great program. So these assessments are Monday and Tuesday this coming week, so next week, 3:30 to 4:30 for girls, 4:30 to 5:30 for boys. If you have a student that wants to go, they need to attend both days. This is just for sixth grade because there's so many kids that want to play and they make so many teams. Seventh and eighth grade play from November to January, and then the sixth grade only season is a really like compact season. So they'll play 10 games in like a month. So sometimes 2-3 games a week. Hardly any practices, a lot of games. In order to get that sixth grade season in. Membership with the Boys and Girls Club is required because Boys and Girls Club finances all of Cunha After School Sports. And that membership applies to any sports at Cunha during the 2025-26 school year. There's still the spring sports season coming up with track and other sports. Go to the Boys and Girls Club website to sign your player up. Phil, you grew up here on the coast side, right? Did you go to Cunha?
I absolutely did.
Did you go to Fairlawn View?
I did not go to Fairlawn View, no.
Elementary school? Grade school?
I did everything in this area.
Hatch?
I was at Hatch, Half Moon Bay Elementary, Cunha, and then the high school. But I do have a great assessment story for you.
Okay.
If you have a moment.
Tryouts?
Assessment really does fit it. Listen to the story, and you can tell me what you think of the nomenclature. I had a wonderful high school football coach who happened as I graduated freshman, sophomore, junior, senior through Half Moon Bay High School, graduated class of 1980. He came with us, with that team. He just happened to graduate also with us. All 4 years, really appreciated him. He apparently was an outstanding baseball player in his youth. He had coached the Half Moon Bay High School baseball team in years previous, but he was so concerned and so interested, he actually had to give up coaching because he was literally taking it home every night. It wasn't good for his marriage. In my senior season, he decides to come back, and we're all very excited to have this very knowledgeable baseball coach back. Before the season, now he's seen me for 4 years as a football player, and he's banking his assessments. He calls me into his office before the baseball season. He says, "Hey, Plath, I've been asking around some of your ex-teammates. What I understand about you is kind of like football. You like to run around. If there's someone on the base path, you don't mind running them over. You maybe will make a catch and you'll maybe get a hit." And I thought of that assessment and I said, "Absolutely, coach, that's exactly how I am." He says, "Why don't you not come out
Oh.
And I thought for only a moment. I said, all right, I get it. Wow. Now, our team that year had a great season with a lot of quality players. I can only imagine my coach knowing me. Now, I don't think he would have done that to someone that he did not know. He would have had me out there with tryouts. I might have made the team. I might not have. But he thought, I don't want to mess around with this guy who had a good enough, you know, high school football career. Let's not sully it with a bad baseball senior season. I can't remember exactly what I thought at that moment in the week after, or maybe the weeks after, when some of my classmates might have asked, hey, Phil, why aren't you coming out, you know, for the baseball team? But I look back on it now decades later, and I think, first of all, couldn't happen today. Second of all, you know what? I actually appreciate that. You've made your assessment. It's a knowledgeable assessment. Tell me whether or not you think I'm going to be a part of this team, whether or not you think I can help. Give me that blunt truth.
And he also gave you the out where you didn't try out and not make it, and then everybody know that you had not made it, versus you being able to potentially just be like, oh, I'm just so busy with football, or I've got all these things going on, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I really appreciated it. I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, kind of in line with assessment, tryouts now being called assessments, which, again, I'm not sure that's a better name, but that's what it is. Yeah, that could not happen today. I feel like a coach is going to get sued by an angry parent if they tell the kid, like, you know, really.
Some of the gnarliest, because, you know, I don't have kids, so I never have been around that stuff for very, like, long periods of time. But one of my old places that we lived was on a street where the end of the cul-de-sac was a kid's baseball field. So every weekend, you know, just 1,000 parents and kids are coming to play the game at the end of our street. And some of the gnarliest arguments I have ever heard was moms going after coaches because their kid absolutely should be on the A squad. There's one in particular that I'm thinking of that we were inside our house and could hear this lady on the sidewalk screaming through the phone at her husband, like, how dare this coach? You know, Billy is an A player, blah, 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 and he wants to put him on the B team. And it was like, woo. Yeah.
Well, you know, surprisingly, I think that that is not as much of an issue anymore, because just like pro and college sports have been ruined by the money, kids' sports today are totally different. Like, you go, there's no kids playing. I mean, sandlot baseball, it hasn't happened since the 70s. But there's no kids playing pickup basketball. There's no kids playing pickup football. There's no kids playing any sports for fun in their off time, in their free time. Because any kid that's interested in sports is on a club team or an off-season team or whatever. If a kid is interested in sports, they're playing it year-round, and it's kind of taken the fun out of it and the, like, the community nature out of it, in my opinion. Like, you, I got kids on basketball teams that can't make practice because their club volleyball team is playing, and their club volleyball team plays year-round, you know. And so, and these kids, they're exhausted from it. Mm-hmm. After they're playing club volleyball year-round, they don't want to go out to the beach and, you know, play volleyball for a couple more hours. It's like, I used to be a motorcycle delivery driver on a motorcycle. And then, yeah, my dad's like, let's go for like a 2-week motorcycle trip. I'm like, Dad, I'm on my motorcycle like 12 hours a day. Like, that doesn't really sound like a great vacation. So these kids are just not. So the assessment happens like you're either good enough for club or not. And if you're not, you go to your school team. It's pretty obvious who the A players are because they've been playing club. B players have never played the sport. So there's really not. I've never seen anybody, like, really beefed about their kid not, you know, be. Plus, the point we make to the B players is, if you're on the, kind of what your coach said to you, Phil, if you're on the cusp of being able on the A team, you're probably not going to get much playing time. You might be practicing with the A team and building your skills in practice, but you're not going to get much time in the game. Whereas if you're on that cusp and you go to the B team, you're going to be a important player on the B team and get lots of minutes and really have a chance to develop your game and come back next year and try out for A team. So nobody's really We've never really had that problem at Coomer.
That might be the difference between the coast side and Monterey.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we'll see. Well, hopefully I just didn't just jinx myself on like Monday.
As you get yelled at later this week.
Okay, here's what I got to... sheesh. I'm very upset about this.
Oh, no.
So I'm a Coca-Cola connoisseur. Phil, do you drink Coke, like, after a big race or something? Like, you see in the Tour de France, like, they literally hand them a Coke as they're at the finish line there.
I have imbibed sports-related, but otherwise in the normal everyday nutrition plan, no.
Yeah, I mean, okay. It is part of my nutrition plan. I mean, I'm a Coke connoisseur, so I check the date for freshness. I check the carton for dents or staining or other damage. I could do a whole show on just Coca-Cola. Classic Coca-Cola, like Star Trek, none of this other flavors or generations. The original classic Coke. Anyway, so it's an important part of my life.
It's so funny. We're so polar opposite. I'm a Pepsi person.
Oh, my God, yes. No, my sister is also a Coke person. When we travel places, there are towns that are like Pepsi towns.
Yes.
Where, like, you can't get a Coke. You literally can't get a Coke. Or we'll go to a restaurant, like, yeah, like a Coca-Cola, please. I'm very specific about my ice and Coke ratio.
Of course you are.
But, well, because a restaurant, if you're not on them, you will order a Coke, and it'll be a glass of ice. And, like, you know, 3 ounces of Coke. I'd say to people, if I can see through my Coke, no.
Yeah, I always say no ice.
So I have to, like, you know, I'm down to, like, 5 ice cubes, please. Because if I'm, like, easy ice, then they'll be, like, the European way, and there's, like, 1 ice cube floating in it. You know, or, like, you know, so I have to be specific on that. Like, okay. So I'm just, Coke is, you know, super important in my life. So going shopping... I shop only local. Don't drive over the hill for Trader Joe's or chasing deals or anything. Safeway, New Leaf. In fact, I saw Frank at both places today, this week when I was doing my grocery shopping. I go through about a 12 or a week. $13 now for a 12-pack of Coke. $13 for a 12-pack of Coke. It used to be go to the Safeway and get a case because if you buy it out of the vending machine, it's probably up to like $2.50 now at like a hotel. It's like $4 for, if you can even find a vending machine in a hotel anymore, it's like $4 for a can of Coke. So you'd always be like, yeah, just buy a 12-pack. You're getting them for like 35 cents each. It's over a dollar a Coke now when you buy them bulk. That is ridiculous.
I don't know if you've noticed, but the cost of everything has skyrocketed.
Yes, I was telling Frank, I keep my receipts just to see what I like to do the price of right thing. I was always good at that as a kid, like watching that, you know, with my grandma or whatever. Like, and so I just like to stay up on, it's shocking.
Yeah.
Shocking what things are costing nowadays. Okay, so very unhappy about that. Okay, real quick, Half Moon Bay High School. Hold on. So back to Cunha. So Phil, you went to Cunha. Did you play sports for the Cunha school?
I don't remember that. No, I remember recess at Cunha. I don't remember playing for any teams there, no.
Okay. I think back in that day, they might... Well, the Cunha field, apparently, back in that day was awful. Like, uneven, like, potholed. It was grass, in air quotes. So, anyways, but it's, you know, an awesome field. Speaking of which, Half Moon Bay High School baseball... The team was coming together last season. Their talk is they're going to be good this season. They've got two major, major dates coming up. Opening day, February 25th at 3:30 p.m., home game versus Lincoln. It's going to be a big celebration for the first game on the newly refurbished baseball field. So Boys and Girls Club with Cabrillo Unified School District, as they did with Cunha Athletic Field, got the money together, got the project together, and refurbished the Cunha soccer field. They've done the same for the baseball field. On opening day, we're going to have band, cheerleaders, bunting, a live singing of Star Spangled Banner, dignitaries, ribbon cutting, food truck, all of this stuff to get together to celebrate the new field and opening day for the Half Moon Bay High School baseball season. Anybody listening, we're working on trying to get a current or retired San Francisco Giant to be there. So if you have any connections, if you know any Giants or know anybody in the Giants organization, please send an email to us at coastalwindage@gmail.com or Athletic Director Mike Berrigan at the high school or Executive Director Mark Newton of the Boys and Girls Club. Let's go to a commercial break. We'll be right back with Phil Plath right after this.
This is Community Radio for the Coast Side.
100.9 KHMB.
Coastal Windage is brought to you by Cameron's Restaurant and Pub in Half Moon Bay. Come for the food, stay for the fun. That's Cameron's Restaurant and Pub on Highway 1 in Half Moon Bay.
This is Jay Michaels. Make sure to join me and Stan Warren Luttrell coming up at 10 o'clock right after Coastal Windage. We'll have a look at today in history, plus we'll get to a brand new forgotten find. It all happens at 10 a.m. right here from 100.9 FM KHMB.
Okay, real quick. So they've got the opening day. That's February 25th. Then this is super cool. The Half Moon Bay High School baseball team is going to play in Oracle Park on April 10th. That's right. Hold on. I got to do my Howard Cosell voice. Chrislyn, do you know Howard Cosell?
And this just in, Half Moon Bay High to play Sequoia at Oracle Park on April 10th.
Oh, my God. That's the worst Howard Cosell I've ever heard. Okay, never mind. That'll be April 10th at 8 p.m. So a night game in Oracle Park against Sequoia High School. Half Moon Bay High School needs to sell 1,000 tickets to meet their obligation. $25 a ticket, but you also get a ticket to one of three select Giant games later in the season in addition to seeing Half Moon Bay High. So buy tickets for everybody you know. This will be awesome. I'm going to get tickets for all my family. It's going to be really cool. Again, for tickets, contact Mike Berrigan at the high school. Coastside Circuits. This is the middle school team for the Half Moon Bay Robotics Club. They've got a tournament tomorrow at the Cunha. On the Cunha campus at the multi-purpose room. This is their first, the circuits, the middle school team, this is their first competition in, I guess I want to call it their league. I mean, it's a group of teams that they face called the First Tech Challenge FTC. So this is their first FTC competition. It's from 9:30 to 1 in the multi-purpose room. Come and check it out. It's free. Our robotics team, founded in a garage by a local couple, and they have built this up to now there's a high school team, a middle school team, they're building an elementary school team on a shoestring budget, going up against teams from literally around the world. Some teams have over 100 members of the team. We have maybe 10 to 12. Their budgets can go to six figures. Ours are, maybe approaching five figures, and around 10,000. So just really an underdog story, and it's pretty incredible. The Circuits were founded in 2024. Come on down and root for the home team. Go Circuits. Okay. All right. We'll skip the emails. We'll do those next week because we want to get to Phil. Okay. Let me just read this, and then we'll get right into it, Phil. Philip Plath sustained serious injuries from a mountain bicycle accident on November 1st, 2025. After being paralyzed at the base of Montera Mountain and airlifted to Stanford Hospital, going into spinal decompression surgery 27 hours later, to 9 days in the SICU trauma recovery, to 14 days of hard work and acute rehab, Philip is home doing his own recovery. His full recovery is slated from anywhere between 6 months and 2 years. Phil, you want to talk about the accident?
Sure, we can talk about the accident. That was actually a pretty good synopsis. I was speaking with you off air before, Ruben, about your accident. And oftentimes these accidents take place on the routes that we know and that we love. I have been on Montera Mountain for more than three decades. I had been flying down that particular section of it.
What section was it?
We call it the Chute. I don't know what its official name is. It's McNee Ranch, and if you're at the ranger station at the base of Montera Mountain, you can either go left, which is a gradual climb, Old San Pedro Mountain Road, yep. Or you can take a right, and you can go up this
So it's that real steep section that then connects back into Old Sand Pit.
Exactly.
So it's that real steep section.
Yes.
Which is really steep.
Which is really fast and really steep. Mm-hmm. And I had climbed, of course. You have to climb up before you come down, which is one of the reasons I don't like all you e-bikes out there.
Oh.
You need the skills to be able to come down that mountain, and you can test those skills as to whether or not you have those legs to get up the mountain.
You have to earn it.
You have to earn it. There's part of that. And so your downhill skills come along with your uphill endurance, it seems to me, at least.
And the ability to handle a bike going 35 miles an hour. Like, if you haven't developed the skills to be able to handle that, then when suddenly you're given that capability, you don't know how to brake, you don't know how to balance, whatever. Okay,
no,
so
exactly
anyways,
it.
You're coming down this very steep section.
And we, whether we like it or not, we need to talk about dogs and leash laws. You came in contact with a dog. At least it was out in a rural area. I came in contact with a dog at a multi-purpose trail and park that has leash laws in effect. There are signs all over the place. I've, again, for 30-plus years, ridden past hikers, dog owners with their dogs off leash, and their behavior is universal. They scramble for their dog because they know they're doing the wrong thing, and they will utter some apology under their breath. And I, as a responsible cyclist, trying to be a responsible human, will do my best to navigate around them. And on this particular occasion, I was not able to navigate around the dog owner who was, in my mind, trying to get back to her dog, not looking at where the mountain biker was, knowing a mountain bike is coming down the mountain, yet she proceeded to walk right in front of me.
Oh.
The skills that I have acquired over the decades, though, on that mountain bike enabled me to bring my speed down. By the time I got to her and we had this intersection, I hit full brakes. Your dog stopped you. My brakes stopped me. I catapulted over her.
Phew.
And in the crash landing, put an extreme hyperextension into my cervical vertebra via my spine and my neck and my head.
So you landed on your head and neck?
I believe so, yeah. So
you weren't in these kinds of over the top, so you weren't able to get your hands up to...
I think it happened faster than that, yeah. Ruben. Again, as a cyclist, you might understand this. I brought my speed down to the point where as I grabbed finally that full front brake, I was going slow enough so that I think I literally just popped right around her. She had, for example, she was treated at the scene and let to walk away. That's how much I was able to keep the physical forces away from her.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing that, I gave myself the physical forces. So you flew up through the air and wondered about your landing. I did not have time for that. And I've actually seen this in mountain biking. I was following a cyclist decades ago, and she grabbed too much front brake, and she went from riding her bike to on the ground in a second.
Yep.
And I think that's what happened to me. But as I landed, I tried to put the back of my helmet between my shoulder blades. So that's not something, it's not a position you should put yourself in. I knew immediately that I was paralyzed.
Let me back up thank you for sharing this, Phil, and I thank you for sharing it because I'm struggling just listening to you. As you were coming down and you started to brake, was there a moment when you thought, I'm going down?
No, actually, there was a moment I thought with my consideration of the situation in front of me, I'm going to be able to get around this pedestrian like I've gotten around every pedestrian. And what was so confusing to me is that she never looked over her right shoulder to identify where I was to try to solve this problem of these two bodies about to come into contact. So she continued to come from my left to my right. I continued to try to get as much onto the right part of the trail and around her as I could. And finally, again, at that last moment, she literally stepped right in front of me and we had our collision. I've never come up against something like that, and I'm certain never will again. As opposed to a dog running out in front of us, that might happen literally on any ride. But again, I've only seen, I'm going to estimate, 100 of these situations over 30 years. I had previous in the bike ride, I'd come through two or three different packs of people with dogs off leash. Again, I've seen this behavior all the time. I thought I knew what I was getting into, and it didn't work out the way that I forecasted.
So you you hit the ground, and you knew instantly it was bad.
Yeah. I also knew, much to my surprise, that I was absolutely in control of my faculties. I hadn't scrambled my egg. The brain team at Stanford in the first couple of days came through, and they said, Mr. Plath, we don't know why you were able to do what you were able to do to your spine and not do anything to your head, but congratulations to you. We're checking you off our list. You know, go on your way. So I knew that. I was able to give this woman my wife's phone number and actually describe to her where I was. This pedestrian, this dog owner, was not local, so she wasn't able to convey that information. I had to lay there in my paralysis, hearing the sirens all around me, because she was actually giving the wrong location. She had them going to Gray Whale Cove parking, which is where she was parked. Mm-hmm. So
when you were laying there listening to this, like, you said paralysis, you could tell that you couldn't feel your legs or couldn't feel your arms? Or?
So I learned later that there's two manifestations in someone in my position. One is paralysis, which is you can't move a limb. You're paralyzed. The other one is you don't know where you are in space. And they have a name for that, and it escapes me right now. I felt like I was in this position. For the radio audience, I have my fists clenched under my chin and my arms crossed on my chest. In fact, I was here, laying out on the ground, my legs out in front of me. My deltoids, both deltoid caps, were burning, which is a part of the nerve trauma that I had just gone through. So, yeah, I knew, again, it didn't take me long to try to move and not be able to move, and then you realize, oh, That means that's literally the definition of paralysis.
So how long did it take for the paramedics to get there?
Probably not as long as it seems in my memory. One of the things I learned, and of course learned so much throughout all of this, they put up a call for a life flight, and it just so happened that a CHP helicopter was in the area either training or doing anything else that he could get that call and say, oh, I'm very close to that. Let me get down there. So they asked us to look for the helicopter and try to wave them down to where we are. Now, I don't know what kind of training this pilot had, but he put this chopper, which, by the way, was a tiny chopper. When I actually was able to get my eyes on it, I asked the EMTs who were working on me. I said, is this going to be like MASH? Am I going to be on the outside
of
this vehicle?
Yeah, were you in the outside?
No, I was actually on the inside. They said, dude, you've been watching too much TV. I said, apparently I have. But he was able to put that chopper right down there.
On the road?
On that fire road
where
right there.
Where it flattens out at the bottom?
Yeah, that's exactly where I crashed. That's exactly where he put it. And my wife told me afterwards, of course, I was on the chopper leaving, but she said, you should have seen the look on the EMT's face. It was awe. They were like, wow, that guy was probably in a war. Look at him fly that thing out of there. So I had that going for me. And in fact, I was trying to make friends the whole time, trying to keep my spirits up.
Right.
They put me on that chopper, and I called out to the pilot, pilot, pilot. Of course, he has his headset on and his helmet on. I finally get his attention. He turns toward me. I said, hey, what's your name? My name's Philip. He says, I'm Frank. I said, Frank, it's nice to meet you, unfortunately, under these circumstances. And he tells me, he says, well, I've got good news for you, Philip. If you've paid your car registration, this flight's for free. I'm like, wow, look at things going my way. Look at that.
I mean, that, yeah, because in that moment, same, Miguel and Roman, those are the two EMTs that took care of me. Because these are people taking care of you when you can't do it for yourself. And it's like, you know, there's some people that maybe are struggling and they're, you know, lashing out and like, you know, they're scared, they're hurt or whatever. But I guess similar to you, felt like, you know, these are the angels that are coming to save me. Like, let's connect with them. And, you know, so, and now still when I have several times as I've seen ambulances, they stage right on the coast side where they're just gone up and knocked. Miguel and Roman? No. Okay. Like, hey, when you see those guys, please let them know, you know, thank you so much. Same in that. So then you went to Stanford.
Yeah, went to Stanford, and they gave me a typical ER rundown, I guess. Again, you know, I'm still
did
on
they have back. To cut your clothes off?
Well, they did that at the trailhead. Yeah, they
oh,
kept,
nice.
Yeah, they kept my cycling shorts on. Thank you for modesty.
Okay.
But yeah, that was it. I showed up in that position, and I'm guessing it was pretty standard at that point. I heard a lot of doctors around me. Of course, I could only see the ceiling because I had that hard cervical collar on and that backboard that they take you out on when you've done the thing to yourself that I did to myself. Yeah, typical ER rundown of what's going on, a call for CAT scans, and they gave me CAT scans, and I have to tell you guys, no cats.
Okay. Just
lots
dogs. Just
yeah.
dogs.
Yeah,
lots
dogs,
of scans.
Exactly.
Nice.
And later after that, it was MRI. The CAT scan was relatively inconclusive in that sense, but the MRI told them everything they needed to know about how to go forward, which was that spinal decompression surgery that you mentioned earlier.
Okay. So I will say that from my experience, yes, I've never been in a situation like that, but the Stanford Trauma Center for me, for ICU, I probably say amazing, people amazing. Yes, there was a million, seems like in my mind, a million nonstop trips to the x-ray room and to the MRI room and constantly beeping and stuff, people coming and checking. But again, they're all there caring for you in a moment when you can't even go to the bathroom by yourself. So, so appreciative. But I remember being scared to leave then. And so I want to ask you, so you didn't even get to go home. My wife came and got me, and we went home. And so I spent a week literally not moving at home in a chair where I couldn't get up or anything. But you didn't get to go home. You went to a rehab facility. How was that?
That actually turned out really well, although there was some trepidation. None of us know how we're going to recover from something like that. Apparently, at Stanford, Kaiser insured, so Kaiser and Stanford were going back and forth behind the scenes trying to find me a place at their Vallejo rehab facility, which was outstanding, by the way. But I was in Stanford, you know, sort of longer than they expected. But yeah, it was from November 1st, the accident, to the 26th, the day before Thanksgiving, was the day that I came home. So that was actually a really good date. 14 days over in Vallejo, and strides that were made there. It's an interesting, anyone who's been through rehab, a physical rehab like that, will quickly learn that all they're trying to do is to get you to go home and be on your own. To be not a burden to your spouse, to your family, to your friends, and not, you know, and to yourself, right? That day, I mean, I remember that day as a child when I knew how to tie my shoe and I didn't have to wait for mom before I could go run around with my buddies, you know, in the front yards. I had to learn how to tie my shoe. Not learn it. I knew how to tie my shoe. I literally didn't have the strength in my left hand to finish that. So I went from not being able to tie my shoe to being able to tie my shoe and have whoever's with me on my walk at that time tighten that bow up again halfway through my walk. I mean, it's recovery is a funny thing. Again, if you haven't been through it, it might be hard to understand, but anyone who's been through it has those similar stories that we can share with each other.
So four-time California State mountain biking champion, 2 Race Across America records, 3 recumbent track world records, former world record holder in human powered speed, land speed record. And now you're faced with this recovery situation. I know I'm certainly have never been at that level, but what the doctors kept saying to me was it's a good thing that you were in such good shape to start with. And did you feel like that? I mean, even two weeks to come from, you know, partial paralysis and the surgery and the trauma that you were in ICU in, to 2 weeks to then even coming home after just 2 weeks. Do you feel that your incredible physical fitness, 25 years as a, or 30 years as a certified personal trainer, do you feel like that fitness you brought into it was a major reason why you've been able to get to where you are today right now?
Yeah, I absolutely think that. My message, my idea, to my clients before this accident was, you're going to want to be stronger. Later in life, you're going to want to be stronger. Right now, you're going to want to be stronger. So let's get you stronger. And here, I have an opportunity to test that idea. How much better is it going to be now for me, now that I'm that strong, fit individual who went through this trauma? There's not a parallel world to test it, you know, unfit Phil, someone who hadn't been in weight rooms for almost 50 years, someone who wasn't a professional trainer for 30 years. I know that stronger is better. I've heard probably the most compelling thing I've heard from another personal trainer. Everyone's got their videos out there. I was on YouTube watching this individual. I think he's up in Sacramento somewhere. He says stronger people are just harder to kill.
Okay.
And you know, when you think of it like that, that's exactly, I think, the situation I might have found myself in. And honestly, immediately after that trauma, feeling the paralysis, I did not know that I did not have transectional injuries to my spine. I did not know it was only just blunt trauma. If I had those injuries, and if they had cut into my spine at exactly the right spot, I could have gone into respiratory failure immediately. Did not know that that wasn't going to happen to me. Waiting for it. I mean, you talked about your problems with breathing, right? I mean, that's a real thing. I mean, suffocation, when you're feeling that, is absolutely positively a real thing. And I imagine that as sturdy, as relatively armored as I had made myself over the decades in the weight room, that did have a positive effect on the accident and certainly on my rehabilitation, my recovery right now. And every doctor, every physical therapist, every occupational therapist has supported that idea in me, right? Again, there's not a parallel universe that we can test this against, but I'm going to bet on being fit and on being strong and being a little bit more well-armored than the general population.
Yeah, I mean, that's an attitude I had before the accident of, like, you're a couple years older than me, but we're, you know, around 60. Let's just say around 60, which is not a young... I keep saying to my son, who's 18, and other people, like, you know, if this had happened when I was 25, I'd be like, okay, well, I'm just going to have to go through a period of rehab, and then, you know, like, I still got the... I'm going to be back and attacking and, you know, like, pounding. But to happen at this period in life, like when your body's already starting to slow down and break down, like, it just left me with all kinds of questions, like, not just physical but mental, like, do I want to put the to have been so strong. And I literally felt like the day of the accident, like, I was at one of my top physical peaks of my life of spent in athletics, and so feeling so good about it, and then to come down so far, I just didn't know if I had the mental or physical strength to come back. But I think the idea of being strong and physically fit is so ingrained in my life and yours that, yeah, like, I attack the physical rehab 2+ hours a day, just like wanting to do it. But what has not come back for me, which sounds like it is still there for you, is I'm unsure how I feel about cycling now. I've only been on the road bike twice since the accident, mountain bike a few times, just rolling around, but my accident happened on the road bike. So I haven't been on that road bike only twice since then. And I just, cycling doesn't have the same meaning to me as it did before that. How are you feeling about cycling in particular, you know, as you continue your rehab?
I certainly don't want to put myself in the same category as some of these people I'm about to mention. But I absolutely remember as I raced for 22 years, one way or another, started off with mountain bikes and then ended with the track recumbent records that I was chasing. 22 years of amateur cycling pursuits. And I remember whenever a show would come on and I would see a Joe Montana, a Jerry Rice, a Michael Jordan. Again, these are not the kind of athlete that I am, but I was extremely interested in their ideas about retirement. And I have seen, we have all seen, these top-level performers not wanting to retire. And I can remember thinking, well, what's my cycling retirement going to be like? I started riding mountain bikes on a lark. I really enjoyed the workout, and I continued with it. When racing became available to me, I undertook it. I enjoyed the heck out of it. And I think I always knew I was going to go back to being a recreational bike rider, one way or another. Montero Mountain is wonderful because you could ride your bike up and down it, but you can also get great hikes all over it. And so honestly, my last real competitive event was a 2015 hour record attempt down in the Los Angeles area at the 1984 Olympic Velodrome. I had been on it previously to set an hour record, my kilo record, my flying 200 record, and I tried one more time, and darn it, I came up short. But since then, I've ridden bikes to enjoy them. I imagine that I'm going to get back on a bike one day, but only to enjoy it. Maybe to commute. I've done some commuting on it. I can't say until I get there, but right now my mind is open to the possibility that I'm still going to love it and enjoy it. And I've also opened myself up to the idea that I'm not going to be able to do it again one way or another, physically, but probably maybe in a psychic sense. And I know that my walks and my hikes will be able to supplant that. I'm positive of that, although I really do like riding my bikes.
I always said as a younger person, like, walking is not exercise. Like, it's so boring. I'd rather jog or run than walk. And like, I'm not a fan of hike. It just takes so long. But post-accident, yeah, like that, just maybe just like slowing down and enjoying, and there's other things, and you can still like get a sweat going and feel the exertion. But there's something that cycling just had such an important part to me. And so you're not able to ride a bike yet. Are you thinking about that day when you might throw your leg over the bar again?
I'm thinking about it, Ruben, but I'll tell you something else. And I don't know if you can appreciate this. All of those miles that I put in training for those races. And when I say training for those races, my mountain bike training, completely different from my Race Across America training, completely different from land speed racing, from velodrome racing. Everything has its way about it. I tell my wife all the time, it almost seems like someone else's life. So maybe that's why it's easier for me not to wonder if I'm ever going to get on that bike again, because it is really almost a lifetime ago when I was that racer. I really loved it. I hope I do. I haven't imagined it yet, but when I do let myself think a little bit about it, it doesn't seem to bother me. But again, that could be completely different than throwing my leg over that top tube for the first time.
Well, Phil, when you're ready to do that, you know, if you want somebody to come with you on that ride, give me a call, because I know it was a white knuckle ride for me, that first ride. And here's the thing, like, I can ride now, and I still can enjoy it, but the thing that's different is I've told people I don't think I'll ever again be able to just let go and have that, like, hammering abandon that I used to have of like, I'm going as fast as I can. And when you're going for a record or in a race, there's moments when you are, I'm just going to say, out of control, in the sense of like, if a dog runs in front of you or something happens, you're not going to be able to control yourself. You're going to crash. And that's the piece that I can't do anymore. I can't release and just go for it anymore. Everything is hold fingers on the brakes, just like slowing. Okay, we've got a phone call here. We've got about 1 minute left. Caller for Phil Plath here is our guest. Who have we got on the phone right now?
Hi, Ruben. This is Barbara in Moss Beach.
Hi, Barbara.
I'm Phil's mother-in-law, and I just want to say I know you both, and I'm in tears listening to your stories. I'm so proud of both of you, and I also want to do a shout-out to the Stanford team and both your wives.
Now you got me tears in my eyes, Barbara. Thank you so much, Barbara, your mother-in-law, Phil. Barbara's a person I've known for over 10 years. Just a wonderful person to me. So supportive to me. And I'm sure to you.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen so many people appreciate me in ways I thought that there couldn't be. Barbara's been one of them. Her support has been instrumental in my recovery, in my wife's ability to come along in this recovery with me. I know we've got to wrap it up, but Barbara has been wonderful, as you know.
Oh, I know. Barbara, thank you for calling in. Support that you've given me and to Phil. And for what you've done for the Coast Side. Barbara, a former member of the Mid-Coast Community Council, as well as other things that she's done for the community. Thank you, Barbara. And thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Morning.
Take care.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Okay, so Phil, we got to wrap it up. I just can't express how thankful I am for you to come and share your story and to help me and to help other people who may be going through some other kind of rehab or some point in their life where they've got questions about what is my life now. And you are really an inspiration to me and to other people. Dude, you look like you're about 25 years old.
You're charming, Ruben. You're charming.
You look incredible. Keep it going. And when you're ready for that first ride, give me a call.
Thank you very much.
All right, listeners, thank you for tuning in this morning. You can go to the KHMB website, check out the Coastal Windage page. There's a picture of Phil in his rehab. And you learn more about Phil at Coastal Windage. Crystalline, you had an injury story that we're going to get to next week because I didn't want to leave you out, but, you know, Phil
it doesn't compare
himself
in at all.
That's okay. You showed me the scar. I'm very interested. So we'll hear Crystalline's injury story next week. Thank you for listening. Phil Plath, thank you for joining us today. All right, this has been Coastal Windage,
the talk of the coast.